Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for this, the Tuesday, February 3rd, reading of Military.com, read by Ken Beck. Today we'll read the following main articles. New letter to Hegseth. DoD warns of obesity's impact on military readiness. Democratic lawmakers get legal win over DHS, allowed to visit ICE detention facilities. A measured reset, how the UK and China are rebuilding ties through trade, travel, and caution. And following up with miscellaneous articles. New letter to Hegseth, DoD warns of obesity's impact on military readiness. Written by Nick Mordowinek. Military.com. The picture at the top of the article shows U.S. Marines with Combat Logistics Regiment, 37th 3rd Marine Logistics Group, participate in a pull-up competition at Camp Kinzer, Okinawa, Japan on November 7th, 2025. It is morning, the sun has not risen, and we are shown silhouettes of a string of 4 to 5 U.S. Marines doing pull-ups. Rising rates of obesity across the U.S. Armed Forces are an urgent threat that needs to be rectified as soon as possible. That's according to a new letter drafted by national organizations and more than 70 national security, military, and public health stakeholders addressed to the Pentagon and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. The correspondence cites increased rates of overweight service members and their obesity as the leading causes of recruitment disqualification, in addition to being key drivers of early separation, injury, and serious adverse health events, describing all factors as posing an urgent threat to readiness, manpower, and the overall health of the force. The letter's main signees are the American Security Project, ASP, and Obesity Care Advocacy Network, OCAN. With support from other groups and organizations, including the American Diabetes Association, American Psychological Association Services, and the Lupus Foundation of America. Individuals voice concern. Another 13 individual signatories also signed on, including retired Brigadier General Stephen Cheney of the United States Marine Corps, former Republican New Jersey Governor Christine Whitman, and retired Brigadier General Allison Solomon of the U.S. Air Force. Maintaining a force that is physically ready is not optional, said Solomon, also former commander of the Maryland Air National Guard, in a statement. Rising obesity rates undermine operational effectiveness, limit deployable manpower, and create vulnerabilities in our national defense posture. Addressing these challenges through evidence-based prevention and treatment programs ensures that every service member has the tools and support to maintain peak readiness and meet the demands, the statement continued. Dr. Rochelle Corrado, another signatory, is the former director of the Comprehensive Weight Management Program at Walter Reed and a Navy physician. Obesity is a chronic, biologically mediated disease that requires a comprehensive approach to care, underscoring the need for service-specific policies that formally recognize obesity as a disease and provide clear guidance for its evaluation and management among active duty service members, Corrado said in a statement. The Department of Defense did not respond to Military.com in time for publication. Military.com also reached out to OCAN for comment. The picture in the middle of the article shows Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth as he speaks during a cabinet meeting at the White House on Thursday, January 29, 2026, in Washington. AP photo. Obesity risks to retention, recruitment, and readiness. Hegseth's aim to transform the Pentagon was exemplified by a speech last year at Quantico when he called for a new U.S. warrior ethos that includes more stringent standards regarding how service members physically take care of themselves, such as maintaining facial hair and dressing for the duty. Catherine Yusko, a senior research fellow at ASP who leads the organization's military readiness portfolio, told Military.com that this new letter was spurred in part by Hegseth's emphasis on boosting physical fitness within the ranks. Secretary Hegseth's speech clearly demonstrated to us that the U.S. military's physical fitness is one of his top priorities. ASP is focused on identifying the risks that obesity poses to military retention, recruitment, and readiness, and offering pathways to help mitigate these risks, said Catherine Yusko. She continued, "Physical fitness is one element of this equation, and ASP believes that service members should have reliable access to the full suite of evidence-based treatment and prevention mechanisms they need to stay healthy and fit, from physical exercise to nutritional therapy to medical intervention." A decade of improvement efforts. ASP's efforts on this front aren't new. It has been researching and writing about the national security risks of military obesity for nearly a decade, with input from the government, military, industry, and civil society stakeholders over the last 3 to 4 years. That has led to numerous published written reports in the years 2023, 2024, and 2025. Yusko said that more access to such resources will reduce service members' potential reliance on dangerous, rapid weight loss strategies, such as crashing dieting, overexercise, abuse of laxatives and diuretics, etc., which she said can have serious health implications that damage readiness, even if service members are within body composition limits. "Because of obesity's risks to manpower and readiness, we're glad to see the Department of Defense recognize the importance of countering the chronic disease in the military, and we hope our recommendations will help it do so in a way that promotes both military readiness and the individual health of each service member," she said. The next picture shows Selena Vila, bariatric general surgery physician's assistant, as she examines a pre-operation bariatric patient at Brooke Army Medical Center, Fort Sam Houston, Texas, January 29th. A February 2024 CDC report titled "Unfit to Serve" said that just 2 in 5 young adults are both weight eligible and adequately active to join the military. They noted that being overweight or obese, suffering from educational deficits, or having a criminal or drug abuse record were the 3 main reasons for ineligibility in serving. In 2020, 19% of active duty service members had obesity per the CDC, up from 16% in 2015. Between 2008 and 2017, active duty soldiers were reported to sustain more than 3.6 million musculoskeletal injuries, with one study linking obese active duty soldiers being 33% more likely to get such an injury. As of February 2024, DOD annually spent about $1.5 billion annually in obesity-related health care costs for current and former service members and their families, as well as costs to replace personnel who do not meet fitness requirements. Lost workdays due to being overweight and having obesity equated to 658,000 days per year, annually costing the Department of Defense an additional $103 million. Yusko and ASP remain absolutely hopeful that they will receive a response from the Department of Defense, with recommendations ultimately implemented in defense policy. Major recommendations to improve health. The letter sent Monday states that a similar call for action occurred in April 2024 when the ASP and more than 50 signatories sent correspondence to then-Defense Secretary Lloyd James Austin III, requesting increased access to vital obesity care for military personnel, along with a review of the process for identifying and treating obesity. After the letter sent last year to previous Defense Secretary Austin, they received a written response from Dr. Lester Martinez Lopez, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs, who, according to USCO, agreed that military obesity is a threat to national security and that a review of recommendations would take place. The next picture in the article is Senior Airman Christian Terrell of the 445th Aeromedical Staging Squadron, medical technician, demonstrates the proper techniques of doing a push-up for Senior Airman Billy Dunnigan, also a 445th ASTS member, at Jarvis Gym in Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Ohio, to improve her core strength following the birth of her child. These are the major changes that ASP, OCAN, and the signatories are seeking to occur under Hegseth's leadership. Obesity prevention in the form of increased exercise opportunities and enhanced access to healthy foods and beverages, per the Center for Disease Control's Federal Facility Food Service Guidelines. That includes periodic service-wide reviews of on-base nutrition environments and nutrition program assessments to develop a broader framework. Early intervention by way of referring service members who exceed weight standards to a medical professional for a comprehensive health review and discussion of treatment options. Evidence-based obesity treatment that includes improved access to safe and effective treatments, including nutrition counseling, behavioral and lifestyle interventions, and FDA-approved obesity medications. Expanded research conducted with additional funding for research that assesses the impacts of obesity on military readiness, plus the potential cost-saving implications of various prevention and treatment mechanisms. Increased education on unsafe practices, such as how disordered eating and unregulated weight loss substances can potentially increase health risks. Assured treatment coverage that calls for a reversal of recent cuts to TRICARE coverage of obesity medications, including GLP-1s, for TRICARE for life beneficiaries and other specialty groups. That includes a reopening of provider networks for beneficiaries under TRICARE Prime and TRICARE Select. Democratic lawmakers get legal win over DHS allowed to visit ICE detention facilities. Written by Nick Mordowinick of Military.com. The picture shows LAPD officers and protesters as they confront each other during a demonstration in front of the Metropolitan Detention Center, calling for an end to federal immigration enforcement operations and U.S. attacks on Venezuela on Saturday, January 10, 2026. About a dozen congressional Democrats received good news on Monday after a federal judge ruled in their favor, finding that the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, may have broken the law after previously disallowing Washington lawmakers to visit immigrant detention facilities without providing advanced notice. All 13 Democratic plaintiffs in the lawsuit are members of the U.S. House of Representatives, who initially joined the litigation last year to legally fight back against DHS rules stipulating that legislators must provide 7 days' notice before being granted access to federal immigration detention facilities. Those members are Representatives Jason Crow of Colorado, Joe Neguse of Colorado, Jamie Raskin of Maryland, Benny Thompson of Mississippi, Veronica Escobar of Texas, Dan Goldman of New York, Adriano Espilat of New York, Jimmy Gomez of California, Norma Torres of California, Raul Ruiz of California, Robert Garcia of California, and Lou Correa of California. Request for comment made to DHS did not receive a response at press time. Back and forth legal efforts. The 9-page ruling issued by Judge Gia Cobb of the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia granting the plaintiff's motion for a temporary restraining order pending further proceedings for a stay, found that the 7-day notice requirement, as initially announced by a U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, in June of 2025, was likely contrary to the terms of a limitations rider attached to the Department of Homeland Security's, DHS, annual appropriated funds. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act was passed by Congress 1 month later in July of 2025. The next picture is of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem as she speaks about the impending winter weather during a news conference at the Federal Emergency Management Agency headquarters on Saturday, January 24, 2026 in Washington. The new guidance issued Monday follows a previous ruling made by Cobb on December 17, 2025, in which the judge said that a rider known as Section 527 required lawmakers to be provided access to facilities without prior advance due to the ebbs and flows of detention populations. DHS had to provide lawmakers with such access with impunity, the ruling stated. Noem responded by issuing a new directive on January 8, 2026, reinstating that 7-day policy by tying funding from that large congressional spending package last summer. The plaintiffs argued that tying said funding to overseeing congressional members' visits to ICE facilities was nearsighted and essentially unfeasible due to the volume of that legislation and the checks and balances that would go along with that. There were also questions of how funds would be split and how much money was available pertaining to such efforts. Cobb said in her ruling that plaintiffs have shown a likelihood of success on the merits, saying that the defendants relied on a mischaracterization premised upon Section 527 and its alleged policy violation. The court has already found that DHS's promulgation, implementation, and enforcement of a nearly identical requirement qualified as defendants using funds to prevent members of Congress from entering facilities as is prohibited by Section 527, because the evidence before the court demonstrated that the only funds used to promulgate, implement, and enforce the prior notice requirement were DHS's annually appropriated funds. The court found that defendants' adoption and enforcement of the policy was likely contrary to Section 527. Monday's ruling states. The next picture shows Representative Jason Crow, Democrat of Colorado, speaking during a news conference on the Venezuela War Powers Resolution on Capitol Hill on Thursday, January 22, 2026, in Washington. This ruling follows efforts made in recent weeks by three Democratic lawmakers to visit the Bishop Henry Whipple Federal Building in Minneapolis, Minnesota, to oversee facilities and their conditions. However, they were denied entry, even as they presented a valid court order. Their attempts to visit the facility came after an ICE agent's killing of Minneapolis resident Renee Good, which sparked local and national protests that exacerbated in recent days following the related death of another Minneapolis resident, Alex Preti. Ruling is a victory for accountability. The nonpartisan, nonprofit federal watchdog American Oversight said the ruling corrects what they described as Noem's secret reinstating of a policy through a previously undisclosed memorandum and shortly after Good's death. Democratic lawmakers have now been restored the ability to enter ICE detention facilities, speak with detainees, and investigate conditions that include overcrowding, shackling, denial of medical care, and lack of access to counsel. Today's ruling reaffirms what the law has made clear all along. The Trump administration cannot evade accountability by walling off its inhumane and deadly detention practices from congressional oversight. Chioma Chukwu, executive director of American Oversight, said in a statement. At a time when the public has been confronted with violent images of ICE officers attacking people on the street and reports of abuse, neglect, and deaths in ICE custody, transparency is more important than ever. Representative Crow, who sued the Trump administration in July of 2025 after he said he was unlawfully denied from a federal detention facility in Aurora, said in a statement that Cobb's ruling is another victory on behalf of oversight. Following the law is not optional, Crow said. 2025 was the deadliest year at federal immigration facilities in decades. The Trump administration is using billions of dollars, taxpayer dollars, to carry out a violent and lawless immigration agenda with virtually no transparency or accountability. Neguse, also of Colorado, referred to the ruling as a victory for the American people. "We will keep fighting to ensure the rule of law prevails," Neguse said in a statement. A measured reset, how the UK and China are rebuilding ties through trade, travel, and caution. Written by Haley Fuller, military.com. The picture at the top of the page shows a Chinese honor guard as it marches during welcoming ceremonies. After years of diplomatic chill, the United Kingdom and China have begun cautiously rebuilding their relationship through high-level talks, commercial agreements, and travel reforms. In January of 2026, Prime Minister Keir Starmer traveled to Beijing and Shanghai for the first UK prime ministerial visit to China in 8 years. The government described the trip as a shift toward a consistent, pragmatic partnership focused on economic growth and stability rather than ideological confrontation. Nearly 60 British business and cultural organizations joined the delegation. This signals trade and investment, not just diplomacy, sat at the center of the visit. Visa-free travel signals a practical thaw. One of the most immediate and tangible outcomes was a change to travel rules. China agreed to allow British citizens visa-free entry for stays of up to 30 days for tourism and business. UK officials said the policy would reduce administrative burdens for short business trips and bring the UK in line with other advanced economies that already receive similar treatment. For companies that rely on quick site visits, compliance checks, and negotiations, eliminating the visa step lowers both time and cost barriers. The government framed the change as a step toward restoring routine people-to-people ties that had slowed significantly since the pandemic and earlier political tensions. Services trade becomes the core economic strategy. Beyond travel, the UK focused heavily on expanding services exports into China. The two governments launched a new partnership intended to support British firms in healthcare, finance, legal services, education, and professional services. Officials said the initiative responds to business complaints about opaque regulations and limited market access inside China. The UK also announced plans to conduct a feasibility study regarding a bilateral services agreement that could establish legally binding rules for British firms operating in China. Services are central to the UK's export profile. The government reported that British companies already sell about £13 billion in services to China annually. Officials further projected strong growth in Chinese imports of professional and digital services over the next decade, creating potential demand for UK expertise. The next picture shows British Prime Minister Keir Starmer, who visits Arlington National Cemetery, Arlington, Virginia, on July 11, 2024. Billions in deals and investment announcements. At the conclusion of the visit, the government said the trip secured £2.2 billion in export deals and approximately £2.3 billion in additional market access benefits over 5 years. China also agreed to cut tariffs on British whiskey exports from 10% to 5%, a change the government estimated could add £250 million to the UK economy. Several Chinese firms announced UK investments. Pop Mart, producer of the popular Labubu toy, said it would establish London as a regional headquarters and open additional stores, creating more than 150 jobs. Chery Commercial Vehicles announced plans for a European headquarters in Liverpool. Battery manufacturer Hythium committed to a £200 million investment expected to create around 300 jobs. The government emphasized that China is currently the UK's third largest trading partner and that exports to China support roughly 370,000 British jobs. Old sanctions still shape the relationship. The reset follows several years of diplomatic strain. In 2021, the UK imposed asset freezes and travel bans on Chinese officials over alleged human rights abuses in Xinjiang. China responded by sanctioning British lawmakers and institutions. During Starmer's visit, China removed travel bans on several British parliamentarians, signaling partial de-escalation. Even so, the UK government stressed that deeper trade would not come at the expense of national security. Balancing engagement with guardrails. Parliament continues to press for clarity on long-term China strategy. The Foreign Affairs Committee criticized the government for declining to publish its internal China audit, arguing that lawmakers lack visibility into the overall approach. Ministers described the audit as an ongoing, cross-government review intended to guide policy rather than a public report. That tension captures the broader moment. The UK wants to access China's vast market while avoiding dependence or strategic vulnerability. Trade is expanding, but caution remains built into every step. The January visit did not erase disagreements over security or human rights. It did, however, restore dialogue and reopen commercial channels that had stalled. Whether this pragmatic reset becomes durable cooperation or another short-lived thaw will depend on how well both sides manage the friction that never fully disappears. This 20-year-old sacrificed his life and became the first Black Marine Medal of Honor recipient. Written by Alan Fraser of Military.com. The picture at the top of the article is James Anderson Jr., USMC, posthumous Medal of Honor recipient. Every February, Black History Month shines a light on African Americans whose contributions and experiences shape the nation. Some of those stories come from battlefields thousands of miles from home. One belongs to PFC James Anderson Jr., a 20-year-old Marine from Compton, California, who became the first Black Marine to receive the Medal of Honor for his actions during the Vietnam War. Anderson was killed on February 28, 1967, after throwing himself on an enemy grenade to shield the Marines around him during a vicious firefight in Quang Tri Province. He had been in Vietnam for less than 3 months. A kid from Compton. Anderson was born on January 22, 1947, in Los Angeles. He grew up in nearby Compton, the first son in a family that already included 5 daughters. He also had a younger brother, Jack. His parents, Agathine and James Anderson Sr., raised their children in a household rooted in faith. Those who knew Anderson described him as gentle, caring, and deeply religious. He played clarinet in the band at Centennial High School and sang in the church choir. He graduated 10th in his class in 1964. His niece, Denise Johnson Cross, told the Department of Defense in 2023 that Anderson took part in organizations like the Boys and Girls Clubs. His sister Mary later told the Los Angeles Times that Anderson's future seemed clear. His whole life was centered on being a minister and working for the Lord, she said. That was his purpose. After high school, Anderson enrolled at Los Angeles Harbor Junior College to study pre-law. He spent a year and a half there before making a different choice. With the Vietnam War escalating, Anderson enlisted in the Marine Corps on February 17, 1966. Mary also mentioned that her brother once said he couldn't kill anyone, yet he signed up anyway. Cross also recalled the decision decades later. "This was a choice that he made," she said. "What strikes me now that I am a grandmother is that he was only 19. Before leaving for the Marine Corps, Anderson drove a 1965 Chevrolet Impala painted Evening Orchid, a rare color only offered for a single model year. He would let Cross sit behind the wheel while he washed and polished it. Shortly after he shipped out for Vietnam, someone stole the car. The next picture is of James Anderson Jr. high school graduation photo from Centennial High School, Compton, California. From San Diego to the DMZ, Anderson reported to the 1st Recruit Training Battalion at Marine Corps Recruit Depot, San Diego. He earned a promotion to Private First Class upon graduating boot camp in August of 1966. He then moved to Camp Pendleton for advanced infantry training. By December of 1966, Anderson was in the Republic of Vietnam. He was assigned as a rifleman with Company F, 2nd Battalion, 3rd Marines, 3rd Marine Division, operating in Quang Tri Province. The area sat just south of the demilitarized zone separating North and South Vietnam. It was among the most dangerous areas to be stationed in the entire war. The 3rd Marine Division had been battling elements of the North Vietnamese Army's 324B Division in the region since the previous summer. Operation Prairie, a six-month campaign, launched in August of 1966 and had cost 226 Marine lives while inflicting an estimated 1,700 enemy casualties. When that operation ended on January 31, 1967, Operation Prairie 2 picked up immediately. Its mission was the same: find and destroy enemy forces infiltrating south across the DMZ. Brigadier General Michael P. Ryan commanded the forward element of the 3rd Marine Division during Prairie 2. He had three infantry battalions, two reconnaissance companies, and supporting arms at his disposal. The early weeks of the operation were quiet. That changed sharply at the end of February. The next picture shows Marine Corps PFC James Anderson Jr.'s platoon as it poses for a group photo in 1966, where Anderson is in the third row from the top, the fourth person in from the left. Ambush west of Cam Lo. In the morning of February 27, 1967, a Marine reconnaissance patrol operating roughly 5 kilometers northwest of Cam Lo Combat Base stumbled into the enemy. The patrol tried to ambush two North Vietnamese soldiers. Those soldiers turned out to be the lead element of a company from the 812th Regiment, 324B Division of the enemy. The enemy force quickly surrounded the recon Marines, who called for assistance. Multiple Marine units, including elements of 2nd Battalion, 3rd Marines, moved to help them before the fighting escalated. Anderson's unit, Company F, was among them. On the morning of February 28th, the North Vietnamese launched a massive attack on Marine positions with over 150 mortar rounds and ground assaults from three directions. The company had pushed through dense jungle trying to reach the besieged reconnaissance patrol. Anderson's platoon led the advance. They made it roughly 200 meters before the enemy's small arms and automatic weapons fire tore into them. The platoon scrambled to return fire in the thick vegetation. Anderson found himself on his stomach, packed shoulder to shoulder with fellow Marines barely 20 meters from the North Vietnamese positions. Several Marines had already been hit. The jungle was so dense, the men could hardly move. Then a grenade landed in the middle of the group. It rolled right alongside Anderson's head. There was no time to throw it back. Anderson reached out, grabbed the grenade, and pulled it tight against his chest. He curled his body around it just before it detonated. The blast killed him instantly. Several nearby Marines caught shrapnel, but Anderson's body absorbed the brunt of the explosion. Many members of his platoon survived because of his actions. Anderson had just turned 20 a few weeks prior to his death. Major William T. Macy delivered the news to Anderson's parents. "They took it well and bravely," Macy said. "They're that kind of family, proud and strong and grateful for having such a son." The next picture shows slow-going Marines from the 2nd Battalion, 3rd Marines, slog through flooded rice paddies during an operation north of Hue. after being landed by Sea Night helicopters from Marine Medium Helicopter Squadron 265, HMM-265, USMC photo. The first Black Marine Medal of Honor recipient. On August 21, 1968, Secretary of the Navy Paul R. Ignatius posthumously awarded Anderson the Medal of Honor at Marine Barracks, Washington, D.C. His parents, James Sr. and Agathine, accepted the medal on behalf of their son. The ceremony marked a significant moment in American military history. Anderson became the first Black Marine in history to receive the nation's highest award for valor. It was a key moment in Marine Corps history. Black men had not even been permitted to serve in the Marine Corps until 1942, when the first Black recruits trained at the segregated facility at Montford Point, North Carolina. Those that served in World War II and the Korean War were often mistreated, overlooked for awards, and passed over for promotions. Anderson was one of 23 African Americans who earned the Medal of Honor during the Vietnam War. He was also one of only 6 Black Marines to ever receive the decoration. Anderson earning the medal signaled that the Marine Corps, an institution with a long and complicated history on race, was evolving for the better. Mary understood her brother's sacrifice. "He acted," she said, "because of his faith and his belief in mankind. He always cared about other people." Anderson was buried at Lincoln Memorial Park in Carson, California. His name is etched on panel 15E, row 112 of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. The next picture is a diagram of the insignia for the 2nd Battalion, 3rd Marines, that's where he was assigned in Vietnam. Across the top it says 2nd Battalion, there's a sword, 3 in the middle of a red field. And in Latin, the words fortis, fortuna, juvat. A Marine Corps hero. In 1972, the Marine Corps dedicated Anderson Hall on Marine Corps Base Hawaii, home to his former unit. In 1983, the Navy acquired a Danish merchant vessel and renamed it USNS PFC James Anderson, Jr. The ship carried equipment to support a Marine Expeditionary Brigade from Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean until 2009. A memorial park in Carson and Anderson Avenue in Compton also bear his name. In August of 2024, the post office at 101 South Willowbrook Avenue in Compton was formally renamed the PFC James Anderson, Jr. Post Office Building after a bill introduced by Representative Nanette Berrigan was signed into law by President Joe Biden. Retired Sergeant Major Charles Cook attended the ceremony. A 20-year-old Black man felt the need to protect his platoon of 35 to 40 Marines, and in that he gave his life. That's a Black man who went through all kinds of stuff before he got there to do something bigger than him. That's a Black veteran, Cook said. The next picture is the memorial to James Anderson, Jr. in Compton, California. It's a slate of black granite with his picture etched at the top, the Medal of Honor next, and then a description of his actions that earned him the Medal of Honor and cost him his life. The post office renaming held a special connection to the Anderson family's past. After the Medal of Honor was awarded in 1968, hundreds of condolence letters from Americans of all races and backgrounds poured into Compton from across the country. Many didn't know the family's address. They simply wrote, "To the mother of the Medal of Honor recipient," and the letters were delivered. Cross said those letters likely passed through the very post office that now bears Anderson's name. Even 59 years later, Anderson's sacrifice remains an inspiration for all Marines. His name is now on buildings, streets, and memorials from Hawaii to Washington, D.C. The quiet kid from Compton who wanted to preach sermons ended up becoming the first Black Marine to earn the Medal of Honor by sacrificing his life to save others. The Battle of Stalingrad, the deadliest battle in human history, ended 83 years ago. Written by Alan Frazier, military.com. The black and white picture at the top of the article is from October of 1942 and shows a German soldier with a Soviet PPSH-41 submachine gun in Barakati factory rubble. 83 years ago today, the largest and bloodiest battle in human history came to an end. On February 2, 1943, the last remnants of Germany's 6th Army surrendered in the frozen ruins of Stalingrad. The fighting had lasted more than 200 days and cost an estimated 2 million casualties. It was the first time a German field marshal had ever been taken alive. It also marked the moment the tide of World War II turned permanently against Adolf Hitler's Third Reich. The battle's conclusion not only reshaped the Eastern Front, but also sent shockwaves through every theater of war. Hitler's 1942 summer offensive. Germany's drive toward Stalingrad began in the summer of 1942 as part of Case Blue, Hitler's plan to seize the oil-rich Caucasus region and sever Soviet supply lines along the Volga River. The city was a major industrial center, producing arms and artillery for the Red Army. It also bore the name of the Soviet dictator, giving it symbolic weight for both sides. Hitler assigned General Friedrich Paulus and the 6th Army the task of capturing Stalingrad. Paulus had served mostly as a staff officer and had never commanded a division before, taking over the Wehrmacht's largest field army. His force of roughly 250,000 troops, supported by 500 tanks and thousands of guns, reached the outskirts of the city by late August. On August 23rd, the Luftwaffe launched a devastating bombardment that leveled much of the city. Thousands of civilians died in the initial air campaign alone. Stalingrad resident Boris Serafimovich Krishnovsky described the bombing as the most terrifying day of his life. Stalin's infamous Order No. 227 was read aloud to every Soviet Union, known as Not One Step Back. It demanded that Soviet soldiers hold every position. The Soviet Union would not lose the city bearing its leader's name. Stalin also forbade the civilian population from fleeing. He believed the presence of civilians would give Soviet soldiers another motivating factor to fight and die to protect the city. As many as 500,000 residents remained trapped when the ground fighting began. The next page is an aerial photo showing smoke from the city center after aerial bombing by the German Luftwaffe on the central station in Stalingrad. A brutal urban fight. German tanks and soldiers began entering the city by the end of August. They overran hastily fortified Soviet positions and pushed deep into the city. Soviet troops put up a desperate defense, making the Germans pay for every intersection, every building, and every inch of ground. Lieutenant General Vasily Chuikov took command of the Soviet 62nd Army on September 11, 1942, with a single mandate. "We will defend the city or die in the attempt," he declared. What followed was some of the most savage urban combat in military history. Soldiers fought room to room through bombed-out factories, apartment buildings, and sewers. Key positions changed hands as many as 15 times. The average life expectancy of a Soviet reinforcement soldier arriving in Stalingrad was measured in hours, not days. Nowhere was the fighting fiercer than the Mamayev Kurgan, a hilltop marked as height 102.0. Whoever held it controlled the city. German troops stormed it up to 12 times a day. The hill changed hands repeatedly throughout the fall. Soviet troops hardened their defensive positions. They famously held a ruined apartment complex, later known as Pavlov's House, for months while inflicting more casualties on German troops fighting for a single building than Hitler lost in the entire 1940 campaign in France. Soviet troops also bitterly defended the grain elevator, Gruden and Mill, as well as the Red October and Barricade factories. The next picture shows Chuikov presenting the Guards banner of the 39th Guards Rifle Division in Stalingrad in January of 1943. German Private First Class Walter Oppermann captured the desperation in a November 1942 letter home. "Stalingrad is hell on earth," he wrote. "Verdun, beautiful Verdun with new weapons. We attack on a daily basis. If in the morning we manage to advance 20 meters, in the evening the Russians throw us backward." Chuikov's tactics adapted to the destruction around him. He ordered his men to stay as close to German positions as possible, sometimes within grenade-throwing range. The proximity made it impossible for the Luftwaffe to bomb Soviet fighters without hitting their own troops. Small assault groups replaced large unit attacks. The very rubble German bombs had created became ideal defensive terrain for Red Army soldiers. Veterans on both sides recalled how at times German soldiers occupied basements and ground-level floors while their Soviet enemies occupied the upper stories. Soldiers fired at each other from the tops of staircases, around corners in small apartments, or through holes in the ceiling. Flamethrowers and grenades were used to clear each room as hand-to-hand combat became a common experience. The shattered cityscape also led to a deadly sniper war. Vasily Zaitsev, a soldier from the Ural Mountains, serving in Chuikov's 62nd Army, recorded 225 confirmed kills and trained dozens of other snipers during the battle. His exploits and memoirs later inspired the 2001 film Enemy at the Gates. By early November, Paulus controlled roughly 90% of the city. His forces were freezing, exhausted, and running dangerously low on ammunition and food. He had already lost 40,000 men since entering Stalingrad. Replacements and supplies became scarce for the Germans, while a seemingly unending supply of soldiers crossed the Volga River. The next picture shows Soviet soldiers running through trenches in the ruins of Stalingrad. The trap closes. While German forces bled themselves dry inside the city, Soviet generals George Zhukov and Alexander Vasilevsky quietly assembled a massive counteroffensive on November 19, 1942. The Red Army launched Operation Uranus, a devastating two-pronged attack aimed at the weaker Romanian forces guarding the 6th Army's flanks. The Axis flanks shattered within days. Soviet pincers closed behind the 6th Army, trapping roughly 300,000 German and Romanian soldiers in a pocket stretching about 30 miles east to west and 28 miles north to south. Hitler refused Paulus's requests to break out. He ordered the 6th Army to hold its ground and promised them resupply by air. Luftwaffe chief Hermann Göring assured Hitler his planes could deliver 300 tons of supplies daily. They never came close. The airlift averaged around 105 tons per day, a fraction of the 750 tons the Army needed to survive. Field Marshal Erich von Manstein launched Operation Winter Storm in December to break through to the pocket from the outside. Soviet resistance stopped the relief force roughly 30 miles short. A subsequent Soviet offensive, Operation Little Saturn, smashed through Italian and Hungarian lines, forcing Manstein and other Axis forces to begin falling back. With that, Paulus's troops had no more hope of rescue. The next diagram is a map of the situation at Stalingrad, marking the city's position and the location of Axis and Soviet forces along the Volga River. The fall of the 6th Army. By January of 1943, the situation inside the pocket was catastrophic. The soldiers ate horses, dogs, and rats. Frostbite, typhus, and dysentery ravaged the ranks. Thousands of wounded lay in basements and cellars with no medicine, no bandages, and no hope of evacuation. Meanwhile, Soviet troops isolated and eliminated German pockets methodically. Tens of thousands of German troops were killed or died of their wounds. Only a few managed to escape on the last Luftwaffe supply planes. On January 24th, Paulus radioed Hitler directly. "Troops without ammunition or food," his message read. "Effective command no longer possible. 18,000 wounded without any supplies, dressings, or drugs. Further defense senseless. Collapse inevitable. Army requests immediate permission to surrender in order to save lives of remaining troops." Hitler's response left no room for interpretation. "Surrender is forbidden. 6th Army will hold their positions to the last man and the last round." On January 30th, the 10th anniversary of the Nazi seizure of power, Hitler promoted Paulus to field marshal. No German or Prussian field marshal had ever been captured alive. The implication was unmistakable. Hitler expected Paulus to take his own life rather than fall into Soviet hands. The next picture shows Friedrich Paulus on the left with his chief of staff, Arthur Schmidt, in the center, and Wilhelm Adam, the right, after their surrender in January of 1943, walking from cars across snow. Paulus was finished on January 31st. Soviet troops reached the basement of the Univermag department store in central Stalingrad, where the field marshal and his staff had established their final headquarters. Major Anatoly Soldatov, among the first Soviet officers to enter, described conditions inside the building as unbelievably filthy. Paulus surrendered that morning. He later told fellow officers in captivity that he had no intention of shooting myself for this bohemian corporal. The northern pocket, commanded by General Karl Strecker, held out two more days. On February 2nd, Strecker's forces laid down their arms. The Battle of Stalingrad was over. Roughly 91,000 German soldiers went into Soviet captivity. Only about 6,000 would ever return home. Hitler was furious. "What hurts me most personally is that I still promoted him to field marshal," Hitler said. "That's the last field marshal I shall appoint in this war." He went on to appoint 7 more. On January 31st, German state radio had replaced its regular programming with the somber adagio movement from Anton Bruckner's 7th Symphony before announcing the disaster. 16 days after the final surrender, propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels delivered his infamous Total War speech at the Berlin Sportspalast. It was the first public admission by the Nazi regime that Germany faced an existential threat. The next picture shows German soldiers as prisoners of war. In the background is a heavily fought-over Stalingrad grain elevator that's pockmarked all across its outside with shell marks. A turning point, the fall of Stalingrad sent reverberations far beyond the Volga. Across occupied Europe, resistance movements from France to Yugoslavia gained momentum. The White Rose Group in Munich published its final pamphlet denouncing Hitler's leadership and catastrophe on the Volga. In the Warsaw Ghetto, fighters preparing for their spring uprising drew strength from the German defeat. For the Western Allies, the timing of Stalingrad was important. American and British forces had landed in French North Africa in November of 1942 during Operation Torch. It was the first large-scale U.S. ground engagement against the European Axis. Those landings benefited directly from the fact that Hitler's attention and resources were consumed by the fight for Stalingrad. American and British support had even been sent to the Soviet Union through the Lend-Lease program. British-made tanks were already fighting alongside Soviet units by 1942, a few of them at Stalingrad. The bulk of the Allied support sent to the Eastern Front would begin arriving after the German defeat in the city. The support eventually totaled more than 400,000 trucks and 13,000 tanks that fueled the Red Army's drive west. At the same time, President Franklin Roosevelt and British Prime Minister Winston Churchill met in Casablanca, Morocco, from January 14th to 24th, 1943. Soviet Premier Joseph Stalin declined to attend, citing the ongoing Battle of Stalingrad as demanding his presence in Moscow. The Casablanca Conference produced the Allies' demand for unconditional surrender from the Axis powers. It also set the strategic framework for the remainder of the conflict, including the invasion of Sicily and the eventual cross-channel assault on Normandy. The next picture shows the Casablanca Conference on January 14th through 24th, 1943. President Franklin D. Roosevelt, Prime Minister Winston S. Churchill, and their combined chiefs of staff at the Casablanca Conference are seated. Franklin D. Roosevelt and Churchill are seated, and their chiefs of staff are lined up behind them. The German surrender at Stalingrad and the Japanese evacuation of Guadalcanal both occurred in the first week of February 1943. Only 2 months earlier, German and Italian forces had been routed at the Second Battle of Al Alamein in Egypt. Churchill later titled his account of this period "The Hinge of Fate," marking the months that permanently shifted Allied fortunes across the globe. Thank you for joining us for this, the Tuesday, February 3rd reading of Military.com, read by Ken Beck.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.